matter your gender. So anyway, let's run down the list, shall we? Number one, lips. I have a scar on my upper lip from a bike accident I had with my brother, and I always had thin lips anyway. So around the time that I was filming The House Bunny, I started getting injections in my upper lip. I did it for a little bit, and I noticed a small difference, but no one else ever said anything. I kept wondering if anybody else even noticed. Turned out, after doing it long enough, the injections became very apparent. One day, a bunch of my friends were like, "Hey, Anna, your lips are getting pretty big." At that point, I had to wean myself off the injections. In the world of Angelina Jolie, who doesn't want big, puffy, beautiful lips? But I look back at the decision to get injections as a mistake. Not because I judge other people for doing it, I really don't, but because it definitely wasn't the right choice for me. Number two, boobs. My breasts were a huge point of insecurity from an early age. By the time I reached my 20s, I finally felt confident enough in my body to accept that little breasts could be sexy, too. I was finally starting to own them, wearing skimpy tops and telling myself I could get away with certain outfits because without cleavage, I didn't feel boobalicious, which I acknowledge is crazy thinking in its own right. But around age 30, my breasts started sinking into my chest a little more, and instead of being the tiniest perky boobs, they started to be the tiniest saggy boobs. The idea of getting a boob job sprung initially from my work on The House Bunny. Not to pin all my plastic surgery on that project, but before shooting that movie, in which I played a Playboy bunny turned sorority house mom, I had never had attention drawn to my chest ever. But with the outfits and The House Bunny, it was hard to look away. At first, I was incredibly uncomfortable with the attention. I'd come to the set of 200 people and think, "Holy shit, everyone is looking at my boobs." Plus, my nipples were constantly popping out of the heavily, heavily, heavily padded bra that they sewed me into every day. It was embarrassing, until it wasn't. After, like, day five, I started thinking the attention wasn't so bad. In fact, it was kind of cool. Maybe I was becoming more like my character, but I started to embrace her kind of sexuality, and it was really liberating. At the same time, I was dating Chris. I feel silly saying this, but he brought out something in me that made me want to be feminine in a very traditional way. But I also wanted to be independent. So one night, I turned to him and said, "I think I'm going to get breast implants." "Honey, I love your body no matter what you do," he said. Perfect answer. Other guys had talked to me about getting implants in the past, and I hated that so much. It would piss anyone off, I think, to hear the people who supposedly love you suggest that you should get surgery to change your body. It automatically implies that your current looks aren't good enough. So if you come up with it on your own, all you want to hear from the person you love is, "You're beautiful no matter what." For a long time, I really thought that getting a boob job defined a person. The woman who would get implants was a specific type of person, and that person was not me. That person was weak and frivolous and fake and all the things I felt I wasn't, which is what makes it particularly ironic that I ended up electing for the surgery. I did it for myself. I wasn't doing it for Hollywood. I had been wearing padded bras for my whole career, so it wasn't like I thought that implants were going to suddenly help me get ahead. But I wanted to feel sexy in a way that I hadn't been feeling, and I'll be honest, after getting the surgery, I did. It was really fun. I know it sounds dumb to describe plastic surgery as fun, but to be able to fill out a bikini for the first time in my life, that was really exciting. I'd recently ended my first marriage, and I was clearly going through a year of revolutionary change. Independence and a boob job. The doctor I went to was great. He encouraged me to make only the most modest change that would still give me the look I was going for. Before I had the operation, he said to me, "Listen, I want to see you a year from now, and I want you to say, 'I wish we had gone bigger.'" That's when you know your implant doctor is really looking out for your best interests. Unlike the lips, I have no regrets about getting breast implants. I'm happy I did it, but I'm happy that I waited until I was 30. It's a personal decision, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it to everyone. But it does bother me that women are very much criticized by other women for these kinds of choices. They are, admittedly, dramatic ones, luxurious, perhaps even frivolous decisions that require you to go under the knife so you can have bigger boobs or a bigger butt. But I don't know why we're quite so hard on each other about it. My harshest criticism has come from women. On one hand, I do understand that drastic body change is conforming to a male ideal, but on the other hand, I've been bleaching my hair since I was 14. I had braces, I whitened my teeth. It's not exactly the same, but there is an element of line drawing. Who gets to say what we can or cannot do for vanity? Number 3, moving on to weight. I've always been a fairly small person, so weight hasn't been my focal point when it comes to looks, but you can't be a woman in America, let alone in Hollywood, and not maintain a general undercurrent of awareness that your weight is subject to constant scrutiny. It's virtually impossible to drown that out entirely. When I moved to LA, I was really thin. I had just graduated from college, so I'd been living on a dining hall food plan. I didn't eat particularly well, but I didn't eat much either, and I walked everywhere, probably 7 or 8 miles a day. So when I arrived in LA, I wasn't panicked about weight. Not about weight, but about basically everything else. I did gain a lot of weight with my pregnancy, and I've never had more paparazzi follow me. I knew why, of course. I was on the bump watch. At the time, I honestly didn't give a fuck. Probably because my brain was numb with pregnancy hormones and I was in a blissful state and all I wanted to do was eat. Food had never tasted so delicious. I mean, food was always good, but when I was pregnant, it took on a whole new power. So even though Jack was born about 2 months early, I gained 70 pounds. At around 6 months pregnant, my doctor was like, okay, you're gaining a lot of weight pretty quickly. But it felt so good to not think about it, which makes me wonder if maybe all along I'd been worrying about weight more than I thought. Maybe the seed had been planted so young that it was woven into the fabric of my psyche without my realizing it. Probably. I wish I had good advice for how to not absorb the weight pressure. Maybe one of you dear listeners can teach me. All I know is that I can't stand comments about weight. Even complimenting someone on losing weight, it's always uncomfortable. Even if you're saying, you look great, can't help but also send the message that you didn't look great before. Basically, it's a no-win. All I really want is to be comfortable in my own skin, which I know will be a lifelong struggle, and for other people to feel that way too. I'm hoping that I will write this chapter and you will listen to it and we'll all realize how silly it is that women are so hard on themselves and each other. Though, having been witness to so much of Chris's press tour for Guardians of the Galaxy and even Zero Dark Thirty, where the big story was about his weight loss, I learned, again, that this narrative isn't entirely unique to one gender. Despite this list of body gripes, I have developed a willingness to be viewed as unattractive, at least in my work, that I certainly didn't have growing up. Scary Movie schooled me in letting go of vanity. Not to say I'm not vain, because I'm totally vain, but when I'm doing character work, I feel like it would be a disservice to the women I play to get too wrapped up in the aesthetics. And should the day come when I'm completely enlightened and have made total peace with my body, I'll still probably be hung up on number 4, my hands. I hate my hands. When Chris Evans and I first worked together on What's Your Number, one day, out of nowhere, he said to me, I love your hands. Please don't look at my hands, I said, pulling them behind my back. No, they remind me of Maggie something or other from the third grade, he said. Chris Evans is a gem. The reality is that I bite my nails and have giant knuckles, and they're basically German immigrant potato farming hands. The only benefit of my hands is that they're small, and they make penises look big. List to live by. Sex on the beach and 13 other things that sound better than they are. Number 1. Getting a book deal. It sounds like an amazing and wonderful adventure, but actually, it's terrifying. I know, poor little actress girl, getting the chance that plenty of more talented writers have strived toward for decades. But to that end, this exercise feels presumptuous. I'm halfway through, and I still have about 100 pages left to fill with what? I hope you're looking forward to the next 7 chapters, a dramatic retelling of The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. As an actress, the best perk of my job is the day I land the gig. It's the thrill of the chase. I'm high on the rush of the win, realizing that somebody believes in me. Then I wake up the next day and realize I actually have to do the job. I have to memorize lines and perform and deal with the pressure I put on myself and make a 6 a.m. call time and hold my face for the camera in a way that looks somewhat normal, which has always been a struggle for me. That's what writing this book feels like. Getting the deal was thrilling. Assuming I can actually do it, well, feels cocky. Number 2, gazpacho. It's soup that is cold. Number 3, hot buttered rum. I love heat. I love butter. I love rum. Why, oh why, can't it taste as delicious as it sounds? Number 4, backpacking around Europe. I actually backpacked around Australia in my early 20s, so I am qualified to say that that sucks, and I imagine Europe would be similar. Number 5, driving across the country in an RV. Anyone who has made this mistake knows it's horrible. I did it when I was wrapping What's Your Number and was in Boston with my 3 pugs. I'd flown them to Boston, but that was late April when they could still fly comfortably in the cargo. During summertime, short-nosed breeds can't fly underneath the plane because it's too hot. Now, dear listener, how does a person get her 3 dogs back to Los Angeles at the end of August when it is unsafe to fly short-nosed breeds? You rent the biggest RV you can find with your new assistant, who also has a dog and a dying cat, and wants to relocate to Southern California to start her music career because the whole adventure is going to be so fun. You're going to stop at all the sights, even Mount Rushmore. Sure, some days may be long, and sure, you've never even driven a pickup truck, much less a 30-foot recreational vehicle, but you know what? You were just given that leather-bound journal by that producer who was nice to your face once, so let's put pen to paper and record the tough times, too. We crashed the RV twice on day 1. Not to sound too dramatic, fine, I want to, but I truly don't know how we lived. Maybe we didn't, and I'm in a weird hell where you have to write down your thoughts and pray that people like them. So, after days filled with Big Macs, don't forget to check the height limit at the drive-thru, being terrified of peeing or anything else because you don't know how to empty the waste, and sleeping in Walmart parking lots, it's an experience I would shy away from doing again, and I recommend you do the same. Also, sad to say, the cat died. Number 6. Sex on the beach. Unless it's the drink, though I don't even know what that drink is, so maybe that sounds better than it is too. Number 7, or in a hot tub. Number 8, or in a car. Not because wanting someone so badly that you need to take each other right there in your Honda isn't sexy, but if you're having sex with your high school boyfriend in the parking lot of Yost Park, the cops could come and catch you in the act, bang on your window, and tell you to get home now, for example. Number 9, meeting strangers at a gas station. I recently stayed at the Holiday Inn Express in Davis, California, where the deluxe room apparently means 2 twin beds. I was visiting my brother and his beautifully pregnant wife. I didn't want to sleep on their couch, and I knew I had to work on this book, so I booked a room at the inn. Well, Mindy, our life-changing assistant, booked it. You know what should go on the list of things that are as good as they sound? Having an assistant. I couldn't sleep, so I walked across the street to the Exxon station for some Doritos and a bottle of water. And sure enough, there were a couple of gals sitting outside the store with a cardboard sign, trying to get to Berkeley. Perfect. I sat down with them and introduced myself. The exchange went something like this. Hi, I'm Anna. Mind if I sit with you guys for a minute? Okay. Where are you going? Berkeley, like the sign says. That's awesome. Why? A friend died. Oh, man, I'm really sorry. Of course, I wanted to know how she died, but we were just getting to know each other. They mentioned they had been sleeping in their car, but between you and me, I didn't see any cars but the ones filling up. I asked them to tell me their stories of why they were there and where they came from. They were vague and hesitant and looked at me with those eyes that said, "Are you a nutcase?" Or maybe they said, "Are you that girl from Scream?" Or, "Can you please just give us a few bucks and leave us the fuck alone?" So I did. I gave them $60 and told them I was going back to the Holiday Inn, at which point it was all I could do not to invite them back with me. After all, I did have two large twin beds. I resisted because I have a family and computers and Ambien. But a few years ago, I would have totally invited them to my hotel room. I probably would have tagged along for the funeral, too. I would have given an obnoxious eulogy and created a gulf between these two nice gals and their friends because they brought some nut who paid for gas but clearly needed a lot of attention. But I would have come back with great stories boasting of my own spontaneity and courage and my new friends with dreadlocks. Number 10, hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. I don't care what Cheryl Strayed says. Number 11, menage a trois, or so I assume. Number 12, waterbeds. Number 13, game night. It gets competitive and people get angry, especially at me. Also, I suck at Pictionary. Number 14, couples massage. Chris and I did a couples massage once in Hawaii. It was the kind on the beach where you're in a cabana getting rubbed down while people are walking by, and it was ridiculous. Was that supposed to be romantic? Were we supposed to hold hands? Chris had a female masseuse, and I had a young man who I'm pretty sure had a boner and was pressing it into my forearm. This is not a humble brag. My husband was right there, and all I could think was, "What's happening? What's going on?" While Chris was reaching for my hand. Was I really going to hold hands with my husband while this guy's boner was pressed into me? You'll be shocked to hear we never did it again. Listener list. Things that sound better than they are, part two. I asked folks on Facebook for more suggestions of things that sound better than they are, and the responses were even more spot on than I could have imagined. Here's part two, the listener edition. Number one. Picnics. Number two, kissing in the rain. Three, Las Vegas. Four, Turkish delight. Five, being home for the holidays. Six, shower sex. Seven, a backyard garden. Eight, whatever product they are promoting on infomercials. Nine, your 21st birthday. 10, potlucks. 11, an adult costume party. 12, taking the high road. 13, girls' night out. 14, Ouija boards. 15, oysters. 16, karaoke. 17, high school reunions. 18, camping. 19, escargot. 20, day drinking. 21, New Year's Eve. 22, Groupon. 23, caviar. 24, riding on the back of a motorcycle. What's your number? And why do we reveal it? I've slept with five people, and at this point, dear listener, you've met them all. Chad, the one-night stand from my college dorm, Dave, Ben, and Chris. My number is five. What's Your Number came out in 2011. For those of you who missed it, and I think that was a lot of you, I played Allie Darling, a single 30-something who reads a magazine article saying that women who sleep with 20 or more guys are unlikely to find a husband. Conveniently, she's had sex with exactly that many men, so she tries to track them down, hoping that the one is in that bunch. I was an executive producer on the movie, and I loved so much about it, but it didn't resonate with people in the way that I had hoped it would. Part of the reason for that, I think, is that sleeping with 20 people doesn't feel like a source of shame these days, and it shouldn't. Looking back, I think the movie's premise in and of itself felt a little bit like, who cares how many people we've slept with, and why are we still talking about this? And if we are indeed ashamed of our number, why? The movie showed a woman who was embarrassed by her sexual history and worried it meant she couldn't be in a stable relationship. but it never really addressed the question of why she felt that embarrassment to begin with. That's the part I wish we had dug into a little more. I strongly believe that women shouldn't feel any obligation to reveal how many people they've slept with. But if they choose to, they shouldn't be shamed if their list is long, and they shouldn't be revered if it's short. And yet, I'm embarrassed to admit that I'm totally guilty of sharing my number as some sort of proof of my own value. Early on in my relationship with Chris, I felt the need to tell him that I'd slept with only 4 other men. I have no idea why I thought it necessary to share this. It ran counter to all my instincts as a woman who should have felt like she could sleep with however many people she wanted to. I fell into this trap of, oh look, I'm precious. My vagina has barely even been touched. I hate that I felt that way. The conversation with Chris took place 5 or 6 days after we started dating. He certainly didn't ask me how many guys I'd been with, but I really wanted to tell him, probably because we'd slept together fairly soon after the split from Ben, and getting into bed with someone that quickly was unusual for me. I felt compelled to explain that I didn't normally do this, so I pretty much just blurted it out, completely unprompted. I've slept with only 4 other guys. Even as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was thinking, why am I saying this? I'm a 30-year-old adult. What am I trying to prove? Why was I talking about my number like I was a thoroughbred horse that hadn't run many races? I was so annoyed at myself. But just as Chris Evans in What's Your Number called out my character and said he didn't care about her number, my Chris did the same thing. He was gentle, but he definitely didn't want to know. I'm not quite sure why you're telling me this, he said. I was telling him because I thought it would be attractive to him, and that's fucked up. You know what's not attractive to guys? Thinking about the women they love with other dudes and discussing all the partners they've had. At least, not usually. Some guys have creepy fetishes, and I can't speak for them. Chris told me that whatever I'd done and whomever I'd done it with, it didn't bother him, and he didn't need to know. That, in turn, made me feel pretty embarrassed. I had been not so subtly searching for how many women he'd been with, and I'm confident it was a lot more than 4 or 5. He was casual and cool about it when I finally tried to get it out of him. I don't know, he kept saying. I really don't know. It was so frustrating. What do you mean you don't know? His approach to his sexuality was the opposite of how I viewed my own, which apparently was strictly a numbers game. If it got too high, I thought, somebody somewhere is not going to value me. This is why I'm terrified at the idea of having a daughter one day. I would love it, but I would also have a lot of complicated feelings regarding teaching her how to view her body and her self-worth. I wouldn't want her to learn any of these crazy, my value is tied to my number lessons from me. And I say that because I do think my own views in that regard, at least back when I started dating Chris, came largely from my mom. Or maybe it was 80% my mom, 20% graduating high school in 1994, when there was still very much a stigma of being a slut if you fucked some dude at a keg party. Raising a boy comes with its own challenges. It's so important to me that Jack always treats his lovers or significant others with respect. I would be furious with him if I heard about a drunken party and got a phone call from some girl's parents saying that Jack took advantage of their daughter last night. There's going to be a day where I need to explain to him that he will have all these crazy urges and he needs to fight them with every ounce of his body. I want to raise a smart, kind son who is strong enough to resist what I imagine will be super intense physical longings. Otherwise, he's going to a boarding school in Idaho where they'll beat his ass. Looking back now, I wish I had slept with more people, simply so I could learn to be a better lover and know how to tackle more positions and make better noises. I'm not envious of the people I know who have slept with only 3 people, but my friend who can't even count the people she slept with, I'm envious of that. That's a study abroad program that I just never went on. But I don't think I could fundamentally change the part of me that has sex with a lot of emotional investment. If I were to have slept with 40 men, the mental exhaustion of it would have wrecked me. Also, as I found out the hard way, I am a terrible one-night stand. I was really hard on myself the next day, wondering if I made a mistake and if the guy liked me and if I was good in bed and then getting mad at myself. Doing that more often would have been a disaster. Any degree of empowerment that accompanied my sexual freedom would have been squandered by my need to please even the most random lover. Thus is the curse of the self-obsessed narcissist. Comedy, fame, and the gross words. My first taste of fame was when I was 19. I was walking across the University of Washington campus, and this girl came up to me and excitedly said, "I just got hired at Red Robin, and you're in the training video." It was true. I played the perfect hostess who picks up the restaurant phone, looks into the camera, and says, "Here at Red Robin, we always give good phone." 5 years ago, Chris and I went to Red Robin, and an employee came up to our table. "Oh my God," she said, "they are still using that training video." All I could think was, "Fuck no." I never expected to end up in comedy. My family maintains that I was a funny kid, but I remember myself, at least in public, as quiet and serious. Funny thoughts were always in the back of my head, but I never said them out loud because it was way too terrifying. I always wanted to be daring, but I couldn't stand the thought of ridicule from my classmates. There was nothing scarier to me than the idea of other kids making fun of me, so I was never the class clown. I was never outspoken. I suppressed a lot. As a result, ending up in comedy was a huge surprise, and I'm still not sure if I've embraced it as my thing. It has not been a Cinderella shoe situation for me at all. So many of the funny people I work with spent their lives trying to succeed in comedy. They were doing stand-up before they got their big breaks, and before that, they were goofing off in front of the class. They had a natural affinity for making people laugh that I never had. There was one time when I was working as a receptionist at my father's ad agency that I remember suddenly understanding the power of landing a laugh. It was the summer before my sophomore year of college, and I was filling in for an employee on maternity leave. I felt so important walking around downtown Seattle during my lunch hour and my little corporate dresses. Nothing sexy, just Old Navy stuff. But I'd sit and eat my lunch alongside executives outside in Pioneer Square, and I had this feeling like I belonged there. This is my new world, the corporate world of Seattle. I would get looks from men, and it always felt good, even though I told myself I hated it. One day, I had a knit dress and my backpack on, and I was getting more looks than I normally did, and I started to feel that rage bubble up in me. This is offensive. Men are pigs. Of course, I also liked the attention. Otherwise, I wouldn't have bleached my hair blonde, but that is the constant struggle of being a woman. Do we love the leering looks, or do we hate them? But I was really starting to brew with anger, until finally this woman in a truck yelled out to me, "Hey, lady! Your ass is showing." I felt behind me, and my dress had creeped up below my backpack, and I was wearing granny panties, and it was mortifying. There's nothing like feeling like you have the upper hand than having your arrogance knocked down 10 pegs. It happens to celebrities a lot. You think somebody is recognizing you, but really there's something in your teeth. But in that dress mishap moment, all I could do was go back to the office and tell everyone what happened. It felt like the only way to conquer the embarrassment was to vomit the story back up. My coworkers couldn't stop laughing, and that was the first time I thought to embrace the comedy approach. It seemed like a much better strategy than just bottling everything up, because at least making people laugh made me feel powerful. Certainly, it was more empowering than feeling shame-faced all day. My first true experience with comedy acting was playing Cindy Campbell in Scary Movie. When I auditioned for the role, I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew that it was my first big Hollywood audition, and I wanted the part. I didn't know this at the time, but acting in a spoof movie requires a weird skill set because it calls for a degree of earnestness, and if nothing else, I was incredibly earnest back then. Even today, sarcasm is something that is fairly unfamiliar to me. It's not my go-to, and it certainly wasn't when I was 22 and totally new in LA. So when I auditioned, I was totally committed. I never broke character, and Keenan Ivory Wayans, who directed the movie, couldn't stop laughing. Like, really laughing. I was so baffled. What was I doing that was funny? I had no clue. Later into the filming process, in a total moment of, "Daddy, please like me," I indulgently asked Keenan why he hired me. "Because you had no idea what you were doing," he told me. Though I'd acted before Scary Movie, landing that role felt like going straight from a high school baseball team to the majors. Not that I know anything about baseball. Keenan was right. I really didn't know what I was doing, but I was willing to completely buy into the idea of Cindy Campbell, and the movie was great training in terms of technicality. You had to learn how to bring a banana into frame at exactly the right moment, or how to get hit in the head with a microphone, or how to rip your shirt open to show your pig nipples. And as absurd as it sounds, that stuff is hard. The physicality of comedy acting, learning how to fall, for example, is taxing. And so, even though I'd never expected to work in comedy, I was grateful for that education as an actor. Also, I'd never worked that hard in my life. I went from being a lazy college stoner to working 15-hour days where things were actually expected of me. That was a great wake-up call. When I got the Scary Movie job, I truly thought I was already a super hard worker, but it turned out I had no idea what hard work was until that film. It was a kind of work for which you give up everything in your life, your loved ones, your home, to move on location, work long hours, and live out of a hotel. I was doing something I loved, and I was really grateful for the role, and I don't mean to sound whiny because I know how fortunate I am, but it was definitely a rude awakening in terms of what a career in acting was going to mean. After filming that part, I started to get the hang of the job, and I realized that I'm incredibly privileged, but the trade-off was prioritizing my career above everything else, and knowing that I'd be working all hours and always on call. And that came as a bit of a surprise. The other surprise, I think, was just how successful Scary Movie and the franchise became. After the first movie was a success and then the sequel was a hit, I very arrogantly got resentful of the series because I couldn't get auditions for dramatic roles, and I'd always thought of myself as a really dramatic person. It took me a little while to embrace the idea of playing a stupid character. For a long time, I took it personally. I worried that if I'm playing the stupid person, that must mean people thought I was stupid. Once on social media, someone wrote, "Anna Faris is good in the Scary Movies, but I think it's because she's as dumb as she plays." You can get 100 compliments, but it's the one nasty comment that wakes you up in the middle of the night. That type of shit used to really irk me, but now I love that I got my start in a spoof comedy. At this point, I wouldn't change a thing about having played Cindy Campbell or about my comedy career. I love the joy that my roles have brought me, like playing Samantha James in Just Friends, which might be the most fun I've ever had playing a character. Our brilliant director, Roger Cumble, had this vision of Samantha as totally psychotic, and some of my best lines were Roger's in the moment. He'd say, "Yell out, stupid dick." And we just giggle and continue to push the insanity. One of the craziest scenes was when Samantha eats the toothpaste. On the day we filmed it, Roger suggested it at the last minute, and I was just like, "Sure, I love that." But because it was last minute, the props department was not prepared for it. If they had been, hopefully they would have given me toothpaste substitute. Instead, I shoved a whole tube of toothpaste in my mouth, and after that, I didn't have taste buds for 3 days. For real. I'd eat a whole bag of spicy Doritos and not taste a thing. With roles like that, I learned to laugh at myself in ways I never could before. I love the challenge of comedy, too, because it really is unbelievably challenging. Part of the difficulty is surrendering to the lack of vanity. I have to understand that the world is going to view me as a bimbo and make peace with that. And there's been a lot of reward in embracing the flawed characters that I play. But I was naive when I came to Hollywood, simply in the sense that I didn't understand how divided this town was in terms of being a comedic actor or a dramatic actor. They truly are two different worlds. Scary Movie was released in 2000, and after that, I started getting recognized every now and then. I've never smoked crack, but it felt like what I imagine the first hit must be like, an immediate head rush. The first time I felt that very specific kind of ego-driven high was at the movie's premiere in New York. It was my first premiere, and I really felt like I was in this magical ecstasy dream. There were people calling my name. Well, they were saying Anna, rhymes with banana, but I didn't give a shit. Someone lent me a dress, and I was staying at a fancy hotel, and executives were saying that the movie was going to make more than they ever thought possible, and it was an unbelievable out-of-body euphoria. After the movie came out, I returned to blonde. Cindy Campbell was a brunette, so I didn't get noticed in public very often. A couple of times, people thought I was Britney Spears, which was flattering, but even though I wasn't consistently being spotted, I'll admit I had a few ugly celebrity moments. The worst of it came over Christmas 2002, when I was 26. I went with my brother and cousins to a bowling alley near my parents' place in Washington, and after a couple of hours hanging out at the bar, the manager cut me off. I'd only had two beers and wasn't especially drunk, and I got annoyed, which I think was fair, except that it provoked me to utter that very hideous phrase, "Don't you know who I am?" As soon as the words came out of my mouth, all I could think was, "What the fuck did I just say?" The manager's response, "You're out of here." She didn't know or care who I was, and I can't say I blame her. I felt such shame, not for getting kicked out of the bowling alley bar, but for uttering those words. Had I really become that gross? Was I really the person who was drunk on her own ego? And what had I done, really? The hot chick? When I woke up the next day, I was horribly embarrassed. I could hardly recognize myself. What kind of self-important person utters that phrase? I'm just so glad that we didn't yet live in a world where everyone had their iPhone in hand at all times. There was no social media or viral videos. In that regard, I got lucky. But I didn't know in that moment to be thankful that Facebook didn't exist yet. Instead, I kept thinking of how disappointed and mortified my parents would have been if they had heard me say that kind of thing. That knowledge haunted me, and I was ashamed. Looking back on that evening, at the risk of sounding like a total cliche, I think I was destined to learn that lesson the hard way. In the wake of Scary Movie's early success, it was really difficult to go from merely dreaming of acting in Hollywood to getting a role to suddenly having people kiss my ass who only 3 days earlier viewed me with skepticism. And of course, I wanted to believe that I was as great as everyone was saying I was. It became a mindfuck, and sifting through the noise to find the people I could trust to actually look at my work and see my potential but also keep me grounded was tricky. That night at the bowling alley was a wake-up call. 15 years later, I still have complicated feelings about fame. Don't get me wrong, I feel incredibly lucky and grateful to have the life and career that I do. I remember watching Gwyneth Paltrow on Oprah after she won Best Actress for Shakespeare in Love in the late 90s. Oprah said something like, "You're hugely famous now, what's that like?" Gwyneth described it as white hot and started to complain a little bit. I wasn't famous at all at that point, but I remember seeing that clip and thinking if I ever succeeded in Hollywood, I would never complain about fame like that. But it does make you feel vulnerable. I realize that now. Truth be told, I have a lot of guilt wrapped up in my success. I'm glad that I feel good about what I do creatively, and I've worked incredibly hard for my career, but there is a degree of embarrassment around getting put on a weird pedestal and being in a job that's valued more than somebody who does something else for a living that is perhaps more important but not nearly as luxurious. There's nowhere where Hollywood's self-important attitude is on display more than at award shows. My brother once told me that no industry in the world congratulates itself as much as the entertainment industry, and he was right. Not that I'm drowning in statuettes, but I should point out that you are listening to a book written by none other than the High Times 2007 Stonette of the Year. The red carpet, for all its fanfare, is actually a really humbling experience. Even if you're at, say, the Oscars and some people are yelling your name, you end up behind Brad and Angelina or Nicole Kidman and Keith Urban, and it's just, well, let's just say you don't have any delusion about who the crowd is there for. Suddenly, what you think is going to be an ego-charged evening becomes sort of humiliating, and if you have any self-awareness at all, you can't stop thinking about what a fucking jerk you are, because who are you trying to fool? What I'm saying is that I can't take it all too seriously, especially as people are snapping my photo. It's hard for me not to think, can't you see my flaws? I don't deserve this. I think that's why I always look the slightest bit awkward in red carpet photos. I don't know how to hold my face, and I always have my mouth just slightly open. You're supposed to pose your leg or hold your jaw in a certain way, but I can't bring myself to do it. It feels so not me. I'm the one blowing a kiss to photographers, which drives my publicist crazy. It's a silly move, and my publicist, God bless her, just wants me to be perceived as a serious actress. But even if I attempted to be calculated and glamorous and look like a Hollywood untouchable on the red carpet, someone would catch me picking my nose, so why even pretend? Can you imagine a photo of Angelina digging for a booger at the Oscars? No. That's why she really is an untouchable, and I'm me. There's a perception that if you take yourself seriously on the red carpet, then the industry in general will take you more seriously. Well, except Jennifer Lawrence. She, to her credit, doesn't take herself seriously and is still considered the pinnacle of a serious actress. But she wasn't in Scary Movie 1, 2, 3, and 4, and she's the face of Dior. I had a Jergens self-tanning campaign once. Not that it's a competition. Well, I guess the awards are, by their very nature, a competition, but that's not something I have to worry about just yet. I feel like a virgin in the best way. The worst thing, I think, would be to get nominated for an award, lose, and never get nominated again. You have all these people talking to you every day for 2 months about your nomination. Then you have to get an address and plaster your face and take a Valium and wait to have your name not called. I'm okay with having sidestepped that. But if I do ever get nominated, the good news is that I've delivered plenty of drunken acceptance speeches at Allison Janney's house, where her 7 Emmys are perfect for my practice runs. You know, just in case. Unqualified advice. The bush is back. The other night, I had a dream that I had a huge hairy bush and I lived in a cabin in the mountains. I was nervous, I think, about my huge bush, but I loved being in that cabin. It's funny that I would have that dream, actually, because I recently started laser hair removal. The place I go to for facials offers the service, and when I was checking out one day, they told me they were offering laser service for a discount, so I started doing my bikini area. Why not? I was totally late to the game, though. I was 39 when I started this process that you should probably be starting when you're, like, 25 if you're going to do it. The good news, for those of you considering it, laser is so much less painful than waxing. It hurts, but they have this whole new cooling thing that they use while you're getting the treatment, and it's nothing compared to getting your skin ripped off with hot wax. To be clear, I'm not bare. I just wanted to get cleaned up so that I wouldn't have to worry about shaving when I put on a bathing suit. After I started, I went to my gynecologist, and I was like, guess what? I got lasered. Aren't you proud of me? She just looked at me and said, oh, honey, you're getting lasered now? The bush is back. This is a Beverly Hills gynecologist. She knows what she's talking about. It is so like me to do something just as the trend is waning. Body hair is a complicated issue. Growing up in Seattle, I was incredibly lazy about shaving my legs and was really unknowledgeable about body grooming in general. It wasn't something my mother was especially concerned with, so she didn't teach me much in the way of hair maintenance. I had never been waxed before I moved to LA, and even then, I lived here for 8 or 9 years before I tried it for the first time. I always shaved my bikini line. It wasn't all just free-flowing, but I'd never waxed, and I certainly didn't know that they also did your butt. That was a real surprise. One time I was at a pool party with a guy I was seeing, and I was wearing a white bikini. As I started walking toward the house from the pool, my date yelled, "Hey, Anna, your pussy's showing." I looked down, and I was covered, but I think maybe you could see a hint of darkness through the suit. I was so mortified. And I remember everyone looking at me, not at my crotch, but just watching, wondering how I was going to react. I walked away, but it was cruel and humiliating, and it felt like a truly low blow. There's a whole thing about body hair when you're pregnant, too. So many people are examining your vagina on a regular basis, and while I was pregnant with Jack, I really wanted to know what the protocol was. Are you expected to be more maintained? Is that, like, a courtesy you should be showing your doctor? Or is pregnancy when you are supposed to really embrace your natural motherliness? Generally, I like to keep myself groomed, but I did grow out my armpit hair once. I was filming The Dictator, and I played a Williamsburg militant type, and when I was cast, they asked me if I'd mind not shaving for a while, so I said sure. By 3 weeks in, it was really starting to get sick. I guess I thought that there would be less than there was, but it was a lot, and it was kind of straight and wiry, but then it got curly at the end in this wispy, disgusting way. I think I could have handled it better if it was curly from the onset, like a man's beard, but my hair couldn't make up its mind, and it was dark. My pubic hair is not blonde, but it's not super dark, but my armpit hair was black. For the duration of filming, that hair became my identity. I couldn't stop thinking about it. Plus, we were filming in New York in the summer, so it was hot and sweaty and just generally unpleasant. As the movie progressed, there would be moments when I was supposed to raise my arms, and even while we were shooting, I could see the look in the crew's eyes when they spotted my pits. There was horror in those eyes. The hairy armpits definitely affected my feelings of attractiveness. I wish it could have been like, I am woman, I own this shit. But I just couldn't. I did not own that shit. I do remember the very real struggle of trying to hail a cab in New York during that time. I'd keep my elbows glued to my rib cage in the least aggressive taxi hail ever. The hair was kind of like a giant tattoo. When something on your body goes against the norm in that way, it becomes a badge, whether you like it or not. You have to understand that it will be a talking point behind your back. And for some people, that is what they want. But I just can't handle the inner demons of that. I'm an actress. I care too much what other people think. Chris was in LA while I shot The Dictator, and I can't imagine he loved the hairy pits. But if he hated them, he never let on. He was just like, babe, you've got this. One of the great things about being married to an actor is that he really admires the ownership of a role. So we would talk late at night about the decision of a certain line or creating my character and all that nerdy actory stuff, and he'd tell me he was turned on by my dedication. It's thicker than my armpit hair, but the way you own that role is sexy, he'd say. A lie, but such a sweet, sweet lie. Still, all I could think was, when can I shave this off? The night we wrapped, I got home late, like at 5 a.m., and before I even got in bed, I went in the shower and shaved. It was so satisfying to watch as my hair clogged up the drain. A couple of hours later, I got a call asking if I could hold off shaving, in case we had reshoots. Thank God for armpit doubles. Can I marry you? I am an ordained minister. You know how some people get ordained online because they've been invited to officiate the wedding of close couple friends? So they stand in front of the crowd and tell stories about the bride and groom and speak about love and devotion and the beauty of building a life together. And then after the ceremony is over, all the guests congratulate the officiant and want to shake his or her hand because, oh my God, their words were so personal and touching and they brought tears to everyone's eyes. And why don't they just quit their day job because this was certainly their calling and they were so much better than a real minister could have ever been? None of that has happened to me. I got ordained out of boredom. If you haven't already picked up on this, I do a lot of weird shit for no other reason than to entertain myself. For example, you know those stickers on the back of trucks that read, "Problem with my driving? Call 555-5555. Every now and then, when I'm on the road, I'll call and just say, "Truck 313131 is a wonderful driver." A real live person always answers the phone, always a woman, and they are completely shocked to hear from me. Then they say, totally confused, "I've never heard this before, so good to know, thank you." And I'm like, yep, they are obeying all the traffic laws. I take total delight in the operator being completely shocked that someone is calling to report something positive. I just get a real kick out of myself. When I was in Phoenix filming Take Me Home Tonight, I was hanging out, kind of bored, in my temporary apartment one night. What better time to become a minister with the Universal Life Church? It seemed like a good credential to have on my resume, and maybe one day a couple would ask me to marry them. I fantasize about having the power to do something like that. Also, I wanted bragging rights. I wanted to announce to people that, yep, I'm a minister. I can marry you right now. Ask me for advice, too. A minister. All you have to do is agree that you will attempt to be a good person and you're in. Universal Life Church. Easy peasy. You can also pay $50 or $60 to get the framed certificate, which Chris did once we started dating. I registered under Anna White Unicorn Ferris, and my documentation sits right next to my 2007 High Times Stonehead of the Year Stony Award for Smiley Face. The award is a giant bong. It's the only award I've ever won, but I'm beyond thrilled about it. If I die, or when I die, I guess, I don't want to only be remembered for that award, but it should probably be a big part of my legacy. In the entertainment world, where we give each other awards for the most ridiculous shit, I am proud to have the Stony. It's pretty fucking cool. Back to White Unicorn. You're probably thinking, but you hate weddings. True, but I don't hate them across the board. I just hate the bad elements that weddings bring out in people. I hate the frenzy and the drama, and I hate that sometimes the focus gets taken away from where it belongs. But to officiate a wedding, that's different. I love the idea of bestowing such a grand gesture upon people. Now that's power. I got ordained in 2007 and still have yet to minister a wedding. I signed up for my certification with the blind hope that one day I'd get asked, but still waiting on those requests. A decade later, my minister credentials still hold up. There might be state-by-state rigmarole, like I might have to fill out some paperwork if I'm going to marry someone in Mississippi, but that's cool. A small price to pay to get the power vested in me. Unqualified advice. Unicorns aren't found. They're made. During the decade or so that Chris and I were together, social media took on a life of its own. We were married in 2009, and Instagram, for example, hadn't launched until 2010, so we certainly didn't have any strategy when we began sharing moments from our personal lives in these public forums. But when Chris started his Instagram feed, posting pictures of the braid he did in my hair or of Jack and me on a porch swing, it was flattering that people responded so positively. It was a huge compliment that folks really seemed to admire, or at least get a kick out of, the two of us as a couple. It's hard to know why people reacted that way. What did they see that made Chris and me stand out for them? I like to think that fans picked up on the fact that we really enjoyed each other's company. There are loads of pictures out there where I'm guffawing at something Chris is saying on the red carpet. Usually it was something about our mutual feelings of, what are we doing here? We're just two kids from Washington. Did they get this right? We both have a bit of imposter syndrome when it comes to red carpet events. We're not glamorous Hollywood, or at least we don't feel that way, so we definitely shared a sentiment of, are they going to figure out we don't belong here? There's also the fact that we both come from comedy. I think people relate to comedy actors a little more overall. I had a hard time adjusting to social media, to be honest. I didn't come up in the Hollywood world where you publicize your every move. I was taught that you hide from paparazzi and you don't talk about your relationships or personal stuff. You only talk about the movie or the project. But as we delve deeper into the world of social media, we unknowingly cultivated an image of the perfect Hollywood couple. Perfect, I guess, in a down-to-earth, just regular people kind of way. And mostly it was lovely. We were happy and in love. And we really are just regular goofballs, so it felt fairly easy to keep up the idea of hashtag relationship goals. A while back, Chris asked me if I felt a lot of pressure from being in a high-profile relationship, and I told him that I did. It was an odd circumstance. That he was asking the question made me think that he probably felt that way too. No one wants to live their lives according to a hashtag. Still, it felt that a good offense was the best defense. So instead of being a couple who never spoke publicly about their relationship, we posted silly photos. We tried to let people into our lives to some degree, and that became a joy for us. Because we mostly got positive and loving feedback, and who are we kidding? That feels really good. Of course, social media hasn't always been kind to us. I've had a few stints of bullying on Twitter, angry fans saying cruel things, and it totally hurts my feelings. Well, a lot of things hurt my feelings, so maybe I'm not a great example, but it would be a very odd person who is completely numb to something really nasty that is said about them. Most actors have built their careers off the idea of being creative, but also around questions like, are people going to like me? Are they going to like my work? That's why they cry when they win an Oscar, because it's validation that audiences appreciate them. It's easy to laugh at Sally Field's "You Like Me" moment, but I'm sure that's what most winners are thinking. So much of our success relies on appealing to viewers, and I think only a sociopath would be completely numb to the cruelty of strangers' nasty digs. I imagine that strangers who vocalize their negative opinions about celebrities just want to be heard, but the nastiness confuses me because it would never occur to me to write to Jodie Foster and say, I didn't like that dress that you wore. The motivation there is baffling to me. That said, I've written one fan letter in my life. In college, I wrote to the band 311, and it was a really angry letter. Before they got big on the national scene, they had two albums that my friends and I loved. We went to their concerts and felt like we were true fans who appreciated their art, even if it wasn't mainstream. Then they came out with a single called My Stony Baby, and I thought it was a new sellout sound for them. So I wrote a letter to say how they had disappointed me. I'm sure they appreciated my self-righteous lecture that was literally like, I can't believe the direction you've turned. I never heard back. Despite a few bouts of negativity, overall, Chris and I were lucky to have had mostly positive interactions on social media, and we liked Instagram and Twitter because they were great places to communicate the reality that we were just a silly little family. Or something. I don't know. I bring all this up because one of the most common questions we've gotten on the podcast from single female listeners is, how do I find a unicorn like Chris? But I think the question is less about how someone can find a guy just like Chris, though he is funny and hot and kind, and those aren't bad things to look for in a partner, and more about how to find a relationship that is fun and respectful and loving and that appears, even to outsiders, like a happy one. And I do have some thoughts on that, unqualified as they may be. The first